Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are Mikaela Wieser, award-winning writer and radio producer, and Isaac Yuen, Hong Kong-Canadian writer. And we're talking about their book, which is one of my favorite books of the year, The Sound Atlas, A Guide to Strange Sounds Across Landscapes and Imagination. Mick and Isaac, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark, for having us.
I'm really glad. Now, I've got to ask you some things about, did you know each other and write together before you did this effort?
Yeah, we're both, go ahead.
Well, yeah, we're both nature writers, and we met each other at a nature writing residency in Switzerland. And it was there that we would do hikes in the forest. And we really listened to the trees there. There was something going on in the wind. Huh. So that's how we met. And then there's more to the story, but we didn't know each other before.
Yes. But had you ever written anything together? Isaac, why don't you answer that?
Yeah, and I mean, I think this was the first collaborative project that we worked on. Probably we had like small correspondences and things like that, but this was the first sort of major project we wrote together, for sure. But after this one, we've worked on other collaborations on everything from the librettos to another book. So it's been very...
Oh, wait a minute.
Coming out of it.
You wrote a libretto?
Yeah,
we did.
Yeah. It's called the Sturgeon Stream, and it's a deep time journey from the first sturgeon swimming in the primeval ocean, where there was only one continent, to the very last sturgeon and the dream he sends into the world, and in between a lot of noise.
Is there a recording of this?
You can find the libretto, like the words that we wrote, at the Center of Humans and Nature.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the libretto, it was performed in Berlin and in Denmark. And
sounds fascinating
Finland.
To me. It really sounds interesting. Yeah. I'm an outdoors person, too. I do birds. In the preface to this book, you write about how most people are dominantly visually oriented. And if you were to ask them, okay, you just took this trip, what did it sound like? Most people wouldn't be able to tell you. Talk to me about that, because as soon as I read that line, I realized how true that is, how unconnected we are to the sound environment. Mick, do you want to take that?
Shall I talk? Yeah.
Sure.
So, but you can do it too, Isaac.
Right.
I think, well, there's two answers to that. I mean, there's an really interestingly, there's an essay by Walter Benjamin from 1931 where he talks about the optical unconscious, where he talks about how through technology we've been able to see better, because now suddenly we can see every single movement in like a horse's hoof when it moves, you know, so it has made us more literate. For sound, I mean, we just live in such a visual world these days. It's so overpowering. Almost everything we do is visual as soon as we open the computer.
Right.
And we just thought, well, sound is almost like a portal into a hidden world. And so we did ask friends, you know, not what is your favorite place on Earth, but what place sounds best to you. And they would really get into this meditative state and really think into it and then come up with answers. And you could tell that because sound is something that your body captures, you know, it really sound goes into your body. So it's that wave is still preserved, that sound wave is still preserved somewhere in you. And when you remember it, somehow it seems at least as if they're releasing it again. So when people would then tell us about places that they thought sounded the most beautiful on this planet, they would just tell these amazing stories. It was like almost like you could write haikus about it, you know, just like really intense moments and be there with them. So yeah, that's how this came about.
Isaac, we have strong auditory memories, but do we lack a language to describe those auditory memories? I think everybody has a huge visual, series of words that they use to visually describe things. But I think we lack an auditory vocabulary.
I think that's a very good point, and that's something that we kept in mind when we first wrote the book. It's like our original challenge really was like, how do we describe the world of sound with words? You know, like, and our adjectives and our vocabulary is so, you know, focused on color and size and things like that. So I think it's always the case with things that are, or senses that are not visual. You know, we lack the words. You know, as writers, we always struggle with trying to find the right feel of words or texture. And I think that was one of the pleasures of writing this book, is like, how do we tell stories about sound, things that are physical sensations, in words, without resorting to just, you know, like, here's a recording of it. Obviously, you can listen to it. But we wanted to sort of express it through words and through story. And that's, I think, one of our challenges that we set ourselves on when we first started writing the book.
Mick, yeah. Each chapter is really short, and I both sort of love that, but I also wanted more sometimes. But I love the fact that the chapters were short. I'm sure that was a conscious decision, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, you know, we called it a sound atlas, and we wanted people to go kind of with their finger over a map and go like, oh, what does it sound like here, you know, and then go there and just have a kind of a quick feedback, which then in fact is not a quick feedback, but I think they're quite dense, these short chapters.
Oh, so, yeah, they are. Yeah.
So, but like they are, you know, bigger openings into a wider knowledge, and I think they kind of tickle your curiosity, so maybe you want to find out more.
I found myself, but some of the chapters seemed positively oneric, dreamlike. I mean, I felt like I was reading something by Italo Calvino or something like that. It was like, I wasn't sure if this was fiction or fact, and I would have to look stuff up. Because it has a weird magical or surreal quality to some of these chapters.
Let's say
And I'm sure that was a decision by both of you to do that.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating. You mentioned Calvino. I think Invisible Cities.
Yes.
Probably one of our favorite books. Together. I think it's one of those books that like rewired my brain a little bit when I first read it. And so that's definitely an influence. Another influence is another German writer, Judith Schlansky. She wrote a book called The Atlas of Remote Islands.
Yes.
And it's 50 places I have never been and will never go to, or something like that.
right.
Title. And so we really love that sort of almost like communique sort of style, dispatches from sort of this place where they're kind of fragmented and sort of remote, which captures the feeling of these places. And I think that served as a bit of an inspiration for the book as well, in terms of stylistic, inspiration.
Mikaela, is there going to be an audiobook?
Oh, yeah, we've been asked that. There should be one, right?
Right, there should. That's the first thing I thought of, because I wanted to hear all the sounds that you were writing about.
Yeah, we do have a website where we collected some, like most of the sounds. You can listen to them on that website. But that's the thing. I mean, the sounds themselves, you know, if you don't have the context, they're just... they're just sounds.
Well, your imagination your imagination really runs wild.
Yeah, and we wanted to tell more about the sounds, because sound is energy. You know, it's released somewhere and it hits somewhere, and on the way maybe things happen. And in order to be released, there is so much to be said for those moments before the release. So that whole story unfolds, and sometimes, I mean, we would sometimes, you know, I mentioned Deep Time before, but with, you know, there's one chapter about the landscapes in the Altai Mountains.
Yeah, oh yeah.
A remote area in Siberia, which has never, you know, there've only been nomads living there. So the soundscape there, the humming fields, are still like, I would imagine, meadows before the Industrial Revolution. But for these sounds to arise there, you know, you think, okay, I can hear these insects, and these insects are here because of certain plants, and the plants are here because of some geological features, some, you know, minerals in the earth, and that is there because earth has been moving and something has been happening there. So that moment when you listen to these insects there, you listen to a far bigger landscape than you can fathom in that moment, and that's really interesting, and some of that we were trying to tell.
Talk about the process of discovering some of these locations, because it must have been an amazing process to seek these out. Now, some of them are really well-known, like Voyager's Golden Record. There have been several books just written about that recording. As a matter of fact, I've interviewed one of the authors. And some of them, like the Singing Fish in Sausalito, are also really well-known here. Actually, I've heard them. But some of them seem so damn weird. They're like... they're just bizarre. But talk to me about the discovery of them and like how you sought them out.
Yeah, I think we both came at it from sort of different disciplines and different expertise, I guess. I'm more versed in the natural history side of things.
Okay.
While Mick is in you know, culture, anthropology, art history, you know, traveling. So I think in the beginning of the process, we really just like brainstormed a bunch of ideas on what would make for interesting sound stories. You know, like some of them are more well known, and some of them are, you know, very remote and interesting, and maybe needed some more research. So we went in and sort of just did a whiteboard of ideas, and then kind of pursued them. Some of them seemed always like super interesting, but then the more you kind of dig into it, the less interesting it seems.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes it's like, well, the idea is already there. It's done. But some of them are like, well, we don't know anything about them. And then you dig and you get more interested and more fascinating, and more people are perplexed, or, you know, you come across stories of people also trying to figure these things out, you know, like very esoteric disciplines or very odd people doing odd things to discover certain phenomena.
Okay, wait a minute, because I know a great example that I wanted to ask you about, because when I read this in your book, I laughed out loud. The World Hum Map Database Project. Is that a real thing?
If that is a real thing, of course it's a real thing.
What do you mean? Mick, of course. That sounds something like something out of a Thomas Pynchon novel. I mean, that's wild that there's and it's under the chapter about the Taos hum. But then that got totally in my mind overridden by the fact that there is a database project called the World Hum Map. So there's enough.
It's a phenomenon. Yeah.
There's enough weird hums around the world to require a database project.
Yeah, and especially since people are suffering it from it and cannot explain. Yeah, because these sounds, that's the weird thing about these hums, is that you cannot record them. They assume it's microwave sound, so it heats up flesh in your body, and that vibration from the heat is then transformed into sound, into hearing. So it's not something you can hear, but it's
something you feel.
It's different. I don't know if you can feel it, but it can. You hear it, yeah. So you feel it, yeah.
Wow. You're listening to WICN. Wait a minute. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. We're not on the HUM map in the database. My guests tonight are Mikaela Visser, award-winning writer and radio producer, and Isaac Nguyen, Canadian Hong Kong writer. And we've been talking about their book, which is just a wonderful experience to read, The Sound Atlas, A Guide to Strange Sounds Across Landscapes and Imagination. Isaac, did you want to say something?
About the book? Or
no, I thought somebody was about to say something about hums.
No, I think it would be Mick. Yeah.
Mick? So in every case of the hums, it's mechanical that's causing it?
The hums are, yeah, it's, I don't know if you captured that. I just tried to explain it before. It's microwave, so it heats up the flesh.
But does that mean that there's an artificial source for it? That's what I'm asking. If it's microwaves, it's not natural, right?
No, it's not. So, or we assume it's not. So I think they, in most cases, they have not found the source. And that's why there is a World Hum Map, because people are completely irked by it. You know,
I can imagine.
And it's not just one person in the village who hears it, but it's, a certain percentage in these cases of people who can hear it and others can't. And then depending where you are in your house, you can hear it better or not. And it's just very bizarre. And so people have been noting it down, but it is a phenomena, and it's even here in Germany, in southern Germany, actually near where I was born, there's an area where you can hear it, but some people can hear it, but no one knows what it is. So there is investigation.
Wow.
To my knowledge, there hasn't been, you know, people haven't been able to say for sure what it was or what it could be.
Every chapter is a world that we could talk about for one entire show, but I just want to mention a few. John Cage's project for the organ in St. Bricardi Church in Halberstadt, Germany. What? It's organ squared ASLSP. How long is that going to go on for?
634 years, something like that.
And what does ASLSP stand for?
It's as slow as possible.
Although some people are saying it's not as slow as possible.
Yeah, well, you have to. It was a really philosophical question. How slow it is as slow as possible? And so, talking about mechanics, they thought, okay, so it's a piece for an organ. How old is the oldest organ that can still play? And then they thought, okay, this is how long we know that an organ can play. So that projected into the future, that is how long this piece, how slow it can be played. Like stretching a piece that, I don't know how many pages it is on the on the note, but how long can we stretch it? And so they thought, like, okay, 634 years.
And so it's continuously playing extremely slowly.
Well, it started with a pause, and the first pause on the sheet lasted for, I think, half a year or 1 year.
17 months. 17 months, Mick. That's a year and a half.
Okay, yeah, well, there you go. and then they just add the pipes as it comes along. It being John Cage is quite minimal, so there's never too many pipes. But then you enter that church and you're just surrounded by this one continuous sound, and the organ, the wind is, you know, they have it's an electrical, how do you say it? The valve, you know,
yeah,
the
valve.
Air.
Yeah, yeah. There's actually not a play. There's no player, though. This is all mechanical, correct?
Yes, yes, yes. And I mean, I think the most challenging thing about this is the administrative aspect of this project, because in 634 years, none of the people who initiated this project will still be alive. But how will you keep this church from being used for anything else but for finishing this piece.
Well, people.
That's a beautiful idea.
I love the idea, but people can actually buy a year, right, or buy a time, like subscribe and donate. So that'll help maintain the church, I hope, and the organ.
Yeah.
I love the fact that exists. And in, I think it was in that chapter, you brought up the thunderclaps in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, which if people haven't read, most people haven't read Finnegan's Wake. I love those thunderclaps in that. And I think somebody related that to ASLSP, but I can't remember. I want to make sure we mention a couple of other things. A very emotional chapter was the death of a foghorn. Can you, one of you, talk about it's about foghorns being decommissioned?
I think I can talk a little bit about that one. I mean, the notion of something like a sound that's produced that means so much to a culture, a world, being sort of made obsolete was really sort of interesting to explore, I think. We both kind of went, ooh, this is kind of an interesting story.
Well, it's a sound everyone associates with, like, sort of a fog-bound coast. I mean—
Yeah, it's so iconic, right?
It is,
yeah. Everybody, you know, you just associate that sound with that landscape, but it's actually a relatively recent invention, relatively, you know, like in a couple hundred years. Before that, people, you know, had other ways of trying to warn ships from, you know, crashing into land and using, like, cannons and other things. But the foghorn seemed to work, and it became ingrained in these spaces. And now with the advent of GPS and, you know, everything that's much more reliable, so there isn't really, you know, a usage for these places and these horns. So being decommissioned across, I think the chapter explored mostly maritime Canada on the East Coast. A lot of those decommissioned places are completely silent now, which is like these like giants are sort of slumbering or put to rest now, which is a really interesting image, I think.
It also called to mind that there could be endangered sounds, like there could be endangered animals, like there are, but there could be iconic sounds like that could go away.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of people that are sort of artists and authors. There's another author that wrote a book about the lament of the foghorn, you know, and this idea of that, there is a last sound that's emitted by these places. And to witness that or to sort of feel that is an experience. And it's a witnessing situation where it's like, okay, now it's the passing. You know, sound itself is so ephemeral as well. It always ends in some way without too much of a, you know, like a recording in terms of a physical, with certain things it lingers on. But sound, sometimes we perceive it correctly or incorrectly as an ephemeral phenomenon. And so to have that sort of captured in some way through experiences is powerful and resonant, I guess you could say.
It really is. I just want to mention a couple of other things before we run out. One chapter like surprised me because I never thought about it. The sound of an atomic bomb explosion. I've certainly seen them in movies. I've never seen one close up, but you always assume that somebody's recorded what an atomic bomb explosion sounds like. In the movies, they just do a big explosion and record that and add in some other sounds. But do we know what an atomic bomb sounds like when it explodes?
Yeah, so that was one of those whiteboard topics that we thought would be interesting to explore. It's like, okay, because I think it started from this article in the New Yorker that wrote about survivors of Hiroshima and what they experienced, you know, during that time. And most of them didn't really recall the sound because it was just heat and pressure and all these things. And so, you know, it was a kind of a mystery that really it took a while for people to figure out, you know, what the sound of it was. And that was during some atomic above ground nuclear testing. And the sound is not what people would expect it, because there's such a lag for the sound and the visual part.
Right, the other effects occur first. The light and the pressure wave occurs first. You don't hear it.
And the massiveness of the atomic explosions, that necessarily you have to have a leg, because if you're any closer, you would just get blown away. You know, you wouldn't survive. So, I think the recording that was there was one of those rare recordings that the military, the U.S. military did. And I think it took about 45 seconds for the sound to hit between the detonation to where the recording, you know, the microphone was. And then the recording also features one of the soldiers or personnel there, like, just yelling an expletive because it was so powerful, which is also a little neat detail in these stories.
Wow. I have to believe you both really enjoyed writing this, did you?
Yes. No, very much.
I know that's an obvious question, but I think what I'm saying is, more than most books, I get a sense of the authors really having a good time writing this book.
That's so nice that you say it, but it was like, you know, we would, we wrote it together, but it means that each of us took certain chapters that we felt more inclined with our background knowledge.
Yeah.
And so each story became kind of a present for the other.
Huh.
And
I love that.
And it really was like that. And then, you know, sometimes Isaac would write something and I would go like, oh, this is such a good way to start it or to put a focus here.
Oh, wow.
And then I would try it out or vice versa. And so that now at the end of it, I think it's very hard to tell which story is written by whom.
And I think we're going to we've run out of time. So I'm going to end on that note. What a great story that is. My guests tonight have been Mikaela Visser, award-winning writer and radio producer Isaac Nguyen, Hong Kong-Canadian writer. And together they've written a wonderful book, The Sound Atlas, A Guide to Strange Sounds Across Landscapes and Imagination. Mick and Isaac, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Same here, seriously. It was wonderful. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN.
Thank you so much, Mark, listening to us.
Yeah, I know. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.